Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program and meeting hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by WonderFest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. My name is Tucker Hyatt. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Joseph Henrich, author of The Secrets of Our Success, How Culture is Driving Human Evolution, Domesticating Our Species, and Making Us Smarter. Dr. Henrich is co-director of the Human Evolution, Cognition, and Culture Center at Harvard University. He is also the Canada Research Chair in Culture, Cognition, and Evolution at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Henrich's work has been published in top scientific and economic journals. He has co-authored several books, including Why Humans Cooperate and The Weirdest People in the World. There is a question mark at the end of that title, The Weirdest People in the World. In 2004, he was awarded the Presidential Early Career Award, the highest honor bestowed by the U.S. upon young scientists. He also won the Early Career Award for Distinguished Scientific Contributions, given by the Human Behavior and Evolution Society. Dr. Henrich earned his master's and doctoral degrees in anthropology from UCLA. He also holds a degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Notre Dame. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Joseph Henrich.
Hi, everyone. Nice to be with you. All right. Let's see if I can make the technology work here. All right. So I want to start off by introducing you to a puzzle. And the puzzle is how our species was able to be so successful. So long before the origins of agriculture or the first cities or states or before industrial agriculture, humans spread out of Africa around 100,000 years ago and then across. First, they followed the southern route and eventually made it to Australia and Southeast Asia by 50 or 60,000 years ago. Then around 40,000 years ago, they go into Europe. And then eventually, sometime after 20,000 years ago, they spread into the New World. And by 16,000 years ago, they're all the way down at Tierra del Fuego. Now, during this expansion, they expand into an incredible diversity of environments, from the arid swamps of Australia, the malarial swamps of New Guinea, into the frozen tundra of Canada and the Arctic. And they're able to adapt to all these environments. Now, what's interesting about us is that we have relatively few environment-specific adaptations. And this is interesting when you look at other species. So if you look at species like ants, they're the most successful invertebrate species. So they're kind of our comparative group in the invertebrate world. But they've speciated into over 14,000 different species. And they have agriculture and slaves and lots of interesting patterns, but it's all based on genetic variation. So the question is, how did we do it? Now, I think everybody has a strong common sense reaction here that we did it, well, because we're smart. We have big brains and we can figure out problems. But I want to first begin by challenging the idea that that's the solution, that it's not our intelligence. So to get us started, I want to do something. I have a whole chapter on this in the book, but I want to briefly dip into the Lost European Explorer Files. So these are stories about Europeans and, in one case, a group of Americans who get stranded in some place where human hunter-gatherers have been living for centuries or millennia, and then the explorers are plopped down and they need to survive. And we get to look at how good their big brains are at figuring out solutions to basic problems like finding food and water. So the story I'm going to use here is the story of Burke and Wills. So it's 1860 in Australia, and it's folks in Melbourne decide to have an expedition. They aim to be the first Europeans to cross the center of Australia and up to the Gulf of Carpentaria. Now, this is motivated by exploration, but also by a possibility of having a telegraph cable that'll run down to Melbourne. So you can see here, they're down here in Melbourne, and they want to go across the center, Gulf of Carpentaria, and then back to Melbourne. That's the goal anyway. This is a very well-funded expedition. They're actually import camels from India because they think they'll do well in Australia. And camels actually play a role later in the story. All right, so there's two different groups here. So the lead group takes off from Cooper's Creek. So they have supplies there. They bring them. They drop them. And four men head off with 12 weeks of food. Now, another group is coming up to meet them. They're going to be the resupply group. And then the idea is they'll all go back to Melbourne together. So they have their 12 weeks of food. And after 8 weeks, they still haven't arrived yet, and so they're getting a bit worried, but they sort of smell salt water, they find some brackish water, so they declare victory, because if you're doing the subtraction, they've only got 4 weeks to travel, which just took them 8 weeks of food to go. So they start heading back, things are going wrong, they're running out of food, they're eating their pack animals, one man dies of a disease, and generally they're sort of leaving, so we kind of know the trail, because they left deposits all along the way as they were dropping stuff off. And so the time comes for the resupply group to leave, and they stay. They still have enough food, so they stay. And then finally, they decide to leave about a month later. They leave early in the morning. Later that same morning, Burke, Wills, and King, the three members of this group, finally get into camp, and they've just missed them by a few hours. So Burke has to make a decision: is his bedraggled party going to try to run and catch up to the rest of the party, or are they going to do something else? And he decides that they can follow Cooper's Creek to a police and a ranch about 150 kilometers away, and they can follow Cooper's Creek most of the way. So they head off for this ranch and police post, which is prophetically at a place called Mount Hopeless. So they begin following the creek, and then one of their final camel gets stuck in mud and dies. And now they're marooned along Cooper's Creek because they needed the camel to carry enough water to cross the last stretch of open desert because they lacked the knowledge to find water in the desert. So they're trapped along Cooper's Creek. Now they're having trouble if they can't seem to fish, they can't make fish hooks, they can't hunt. But it looks like they might be able to survive because they're meeting the local Yawantru tribe. Now keep in mind that at this point, Australia has been a continent of only hunter-gatherers for 60,000 years, no agriculture. So these people have been living there for 60,000 years. So they're getting gifts of fish from the local tribe, and they also see them making nardoo cakes. Now, nardoo is a sporocarp, and you can see these are little nardoos, and you gather them up, and you grind them, and then you can make them into a flour. So Burke and Will see this, and they start doing it, and they're, Victorian, so they know how to make bread. Now, the problem is what they didn't see was that the Aboriginals, there's much more to the story. They grind it, they leach it, and then they heat it, and they use a mussel to eat it because they don't want to introduce an organic substrate. Or they grind it, leach it, and then bake it in ash. And you have to do this because nardoo is toxic and indigestible unless properly processed. It has an enzyme called thiamines in it, and it depletes the B1 in your body, and you get a horrible disease called beriberi. And William Wills, we know a lot of, we know the sort of details of what happened because Wills was writing in his journal, he's a good Victorian, he's actually dying, and he's writing how bad it feels to die. So Burke and Wills die of this, but then King stumbles off into the desert, and he's rescued by the Yawantru, and eventually a group from Melbourne comes up and rescues him, and so we have his account as well. Now, what this hints at is that it's not really our intelligence. These guys had months in the outback, but they couldn't do basic things like finding food and finding water, things that any Aboriginal adolescent could do. So there were no instincts that kicked in, no general intelligence. Now, I mentioned they couldn't find water or edible plants, but we can compare them to their camels. So some of Burke and Will's camels escaped one night, and now the center of Australia is full of feral camels. Camels have an ability to smell water from a mile away, and they have scent and taste cues, which allow them to cue in on those plants, which they can eat, and they have systems to detoxify things that humans lack. So they could survive in an environment they didn't evolve in. So they couldn't make traps and spears or fishing hooks. These are all things, like as I mentioned, a local adolescent can do. So you can ask yourself, what's missing from this group? Well, or from Birkin, what didn't they have that the local adolescent has? Well, the local adolescent gets bequeathed a large body of cultural information that is accumulated over generations about what kind of foods to eat and how to process things and how to find water and how to make shelters. So it's this second body of knowledge that accumulates and is transmitted in humans that seems to be important here. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on, is this second system of inheritance, this cultural inheritance. But before I get into the details of that, let me come at the same question from another angle. So this is research by Mike Tomasello and Esther Herman in Leipzig, Germany, the Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. And what these developmental comparative psychologists did was they took three primate species. You can see them pictured here. You got orangutans, chimpanzees, and then 2.5-year-old humans. Now, I put in a picture of my son, Josh, who's 2.5-year-old, so he's representing the 2-year-olds. So the experimenters gave these guys a battery of cognitive tests, 18 different ones, and they can be broken down into a few different categories. So here on this plot, these are the tests that have to do with your ability to understand space, quantities, causality, and social learning. And this is the percent correct on the test. So this is how well these groups did on the test. Now, all three primates really like snacks. So if you get the test right, you get a snack. So they all want to get the test right. Now, the chimps and the humans, you can see they do about the same in space. The orangs a little bit worse, about the same in quantities. Orangs, again, a little worse. And causality the same and a little worse. In fact, if you look at the tool-using subtests, so one of the things you hear about humans is we're good tool users. The chimps actually outperform the 2.5-year-olds on the causality test. But where the humans clean up is in the social learning test. Any kind of imitation, they even have trouble designing tasks where the humans aren't at ceiling and the chimps or the other apes aren't at floor. So the thing that seems to make at least young human cognition special is our ability to learn from others, imitative abilities. Now, in the book, I go through other kinds of evidence where chimps pair off against humans. So there's been studies of working memory, and this compares undergraduates to chimpanzees. And chimpanzees are faster reaction times, and at least some chimpanzees can compete with undergrads in terms of their working memory abilities. My favorite one is strategic thinking. So Colin Camara at Caltech led a study in which they had a strategic game where you had to kind of anticipate what your partner was going to do. And the only way to really win the game, to play the game the way the super rational economists would want us to play, is to kind of randomize around a certain number. So play a strategy 80% of the time and another strategy 20% of the time. So chimps, when playing with each other, zero in on the Nash equilibrium, on the optimal decision for that game. Humans systematically miss it, even when they play the game, because they have trouble doing things at random and detecting other patterns. So these are just all ideas that should challenge us that, you know, it's really about some kind of innate brain power that makes us different. Okay. One final point about this, and this is beginning to let you know where I'm going, is that so one unfair thing about this experiment is, of course, it's not using adult humans. And if we put adult humans, you know, people from this room, for example, into this experiment, they would really clean up. They'd wipe out the chimps in this game. So obviously, by the time we're adults, we're really good at all these tasks. But that's because little Josh there and all of his other little 2-year-old friends are going to keep getting cognitively more sophisticated through their whole life, or at least until mid-20s, and then they kind of trail off. At least on these tests. Other things get better, as you know. But the apes don't get better. In fact, sometimes the infant apes, say the 4- and 5-year-old apes, are actually do better on the tests, and you might have a slight decline as the chimps get older. So there's not this long-running massive increase in the cognitive abilities that occurs over development. Okay, but I want to head off one thing. You might say, well, but there's still a problem here because we're clearly a lot smarter than apes. But that's in part because we culturally inherited a lot of pre-built solutions. So these are all examples of things that evolved culturally over time and over history. And in many cases, we know something about when and where they evolved. So screws, springs, levers, and pulleys. My favorite example is the wheel. Now, the wheel is often thought of as something that cavemen invented. But actually, the wheel arrives relatively late in human history, about 6,000 years ago, and it's only invented in Eurasia. So it's never invented in Australia. It's never invented in the New World. It's not invented in Oceania. And everybody has dogs. So there's always, you know, a cart that could be pulled by a dog the way these Belgian, it's a Belgian scene. I don't know what kind of dog it is. And Australians, so then my next example is elastically stored energy. So nowhere on the continent of Australia did anybody ever invent elastically stored energy, which you use in bows and spring traps. And the same thing's true for compressed air. But once you have these, you can recombine them, and you can use them in all kinds of things. So wheels get used in pottery as well as in carts. And another thing is all of you have been bequeathed a numbering system which allows you to count without bounds. You could just count all day and you would still be able to keep counting. But societies like the ones I lived in, the Machigenga, count 1, 2, 3 many. So they can't differentiate 16 and 17. And when we look at anthropological studies from lots of societies, we find that you can find lots of systems, people will count to 27 in some places, or 16, or 32. But that means if you can count to 32 and you need to differentiate 42 and 43, it's very difficult because you don't have the numbers to do it. So you can't count without bounds. So that's a mental tool that we have by cultural inheritance. Finally, let me mention this last one, which is subtle, which is our spatial cognition. So English, our language, and many other modern languages have three spatial coordinate systems. There's north, south, east, and west, which is our absolute coordinate system. Then there's an ego-centered, where you have a front, a back, a left, and a right. So you can direct someone based on that. And there's another relative one where I might draw a line between myself and the door and say, I'll meet you to the left of the to the left. And then it means the left of the line that I drew between myself and the door, or myself and the flagpole, say. But not all groups have this. So many groups are known anthropologically will just have one. They'll have north, south, east, and west. So they have to solve all their problems and make all their references with north, south, east, and west. Now they get super good at that, but and way better than people who live in other societies that use other techniques. But it means that they can't make a left-right distinction. Okay, so that gives you some sense of how this cumulative body can make us smarter. Now, get to the answer to the question. The reason why we're able to survive in all these environments and the success of our species is because we have this second system of inheritance, this culture, that over generations, by learning from each other, we can accumulate cultural adaptations. The two key ingredients are, one, high-fidelity cultural learning, so being able to copy each other, which is in many ways the opposite of what we normally think of as intelligence. When we test people for their intelligence, we don't allow them to copy off their neighbor. And then sociality, the fact that we're interconnected, we can learn stuff from each other and recombine it. And this gives rise to social groups, societies, populations have collective brains, which means that the ability of that group to produce innovations and to evolve rapidly, get more and more know-how to be better adapted to their environment, depends on the size and interconnectedness of the population. And then the final point that I'll make briefly at the end is that this has probably been going on for over a million years. So these cultural adaptations, these cultural products, tools, and the presence of the collective brain, sort of a group ability to produce adaptations, drove genetic evolution. All right. Now, the emergence of these ideas has been inhibited over many decades now because people dichotomize types of explanations. There's one group of biologists, say, or sociobiologists who want to have genetic evolutionary explanations for human behavior. And another group says it's all about learning and culture. So what the tradition that I'm from does is we take the power of natural selection that has helped explain so much of the natural world, and we turn it on learning. We say, how should people learn? What kinds of ideas should they pay attention to? Who should they pay attention to? And what's the best way for them to integrate different kinds of information? So you think about the cognitive, the psychological capacities for cultural learning, and then you can think about how that gives rise to cultural learning. And then finally, of course, this is going to feed back on the genetic system. I just want to give you a little bit of a sense of how you can do that. How can you use natural selection to think about learning? And the example that I'll give is figuring out who to learn from. So initially, we developed a lot of theory about who that was, but there's now been a big blossoming empirical industry. So lots of experimental work by developmental psychologists and others showing that there's good evidence for all these, even in babies as young as one. So using cues of skill or competence. So if you're a hunter-gatherer, you might look at who shoots, whose arrow tends to hit the target, learn from them. Or for success, you might look at the person who tends to bring back the most game or has the largest house or something like that. Prestige is actually a second-order one. So in prestige, you look at who other people are paying attention to and deferring. So all the learners are playing the same game, who should we learn from? But they're partially informed, so they're deferring to and watching certain members, and then you can use that in integration with other cues to help zero in on who to learn from. Age can also be a good cue. So if you're a young learner, if you're a five-year-old, it's not a good idea for you to copy the best hunter in your community because he's probably about 38 and his skills are way beyond you. So what you do is you copy the best 7-year-old, and then you get to be a 7-year-old, and then you copy the best 9-year-old. So you can gradually scaffold your skills up yourself. Another thing age is useful is that in small-scale societies and societies that have been important over human history, not everybody gets to be 60 or 70, and so there's been a lot of filtering that goes on before that. So there's sort of information content. There's you have to have a certain amount of things going for you to get to be old. And if you're doing something obviously bad, you don't make it that far. So that's a way, by focusing on older members of your community, you can get more adaptive information. And then finally, self-similarity cues. So sex and ethnicity or dialect can be important cues. So there's good reason to believe the sexual division of labor in the human species is old, so males should tend to copy males and females should tend to copy females. That's going to get you skills and know-how that's going to be likely to be useful to you later in life. And then ethnicity and dialect will help learners get those beliefs, social norms that allows them to coordinate. So little kids will preferentially learn food choices, for example, from people who speak the same way their mom speaks, meaning the same dialect or language. They'll also prefer playmates who speak those dialect. And we now know that these biases apply to a vast range of domains. So domains like food preferences and mate choice, adopting technology, suicide even spreads by these cues. So when a celebrity commits suicide, the more prestigious the celebrity, the more likely others will copy them. They copy method, and they tend to match on sex. So if it's a male that commits suicide, males tend to commit suicide, and same with females. And they match on ethnicity. So if a Hispanic commits suicide, then it follows the ethnicity. And lots of other domains. Okay, so these look like adaptations. They develop early by age one. They're automatic. They're unconscious. We found them in lots of human societies. Okay, so genetic evolution gives rise to cultural learning, and then by selectively learning from each other over generations, you can get adaptations. Not adaptations that anyone figured out or racked their brains to come up with, but just things that emerge because every generation people are only looking at some people, the more successful, the healthier members of the community. So let me give you an example, spices. So many of you probably like spices, but spices are an oddity in the natural world. Other animals don't use spices. And the chemicals that are in spices are often evolved actually to keep mammals like us away. So chili peppers, I have a picture of chili peppers here. The capsaicin in chili peppers is actually evolved to spark the pain circuits, basically, in mammals, because it wants to, in the evolution sense, keep mammals away because it wants birds birds are better dispersers than mammals, and birds aren't affected by this particular chemical. But when you look at the details of who uses spices and how they use it, it becomes clear that these are protection against pathogens. So the chemicals in spices kill pathogens in meat, and in places where there's lots of problems with pathogens, the recipes involve combinations of potent anti-pathogen chemicals. And if you go to Norway and you compare that to Indonesia, you can see the immense difference in the kind of anti-pathogen capability of the recipes. But of course, people just like spices and they just use the recipes. It's not something that's designed. The same is true of corn in the New World before the Europeans arrived. Lots of populations were dependent on corn. The problem with corn is if you eat mostly corn, you end up getting a horrible disease called pellagra because you don't get enough niacin. But if you mix burnt seashells or you shovel ash from your fire from certain kinds of wood into your corn mix, you create a chemical reaction. You're adding an alkali, and you chemically break open the niacin, and you make it so that you can live on corn as a staple. Populations don't understand this. They think it's their custom. It's just the way they like it. They'll often give you a taste reason why they do it. And we know this is hard to figure out because Europeans transported corn over to Europe, and lower status groups began depending on corn, and then Europe suffered these epidemics of pellagra that went on for centuries. They didn't figure it out. So if you want to read about pregnancy taboos in Fiji, you can read the book. So these are unconscious adaptations that allow humans to solve local problems, like pathogens in meat or like the problem of eating corn, where there's no causal understanding. And in the book, I actually discuss some cases where if people did understand it, it would make the adaptation less effective. Okay, once you have this idea, then in my business, we build mathematical models, and you can show that the size of a population and the degree to which people are interacting and sharing information actually affects how fancy the technology is going to get and how many tools you can produce. It also means that if there's a sudden reduction in the population should, say, get cut off for some reason, they'll suffer a loss of technology. Okay, so a quick study from Oceania. So this is Rob Boyd and Michelle Klein. And what they did is they wanted to explore this idea of the collective brain. So they measured the complexity of tools at a bunch of different islands in Oceania to get the number of different marine foraging tools they have and the complexity of those tools. and this is a little bit of their data. Along the horizontal is the population size of the Polynesian island at the time of European contact. And then this is the number of tools here. And then that's the complexity of the tool, the average complexity, how many parts it has. And you can see that bigger islands with larger populations had both more tools and they had fancier tools. And what this high contact, low contact thing shows, if you'll notice, the high contact societies with the triangle tend to be above the line, and the low contact tend to be below the line, which means that both size and having contact with other islands leads to better, fancier tools. So that's consistent with the idea. One of my grad students and I were wondered if we could replicate this thing in the lab. So we brought in undergraduates, and we gave them a task in which they could use a complex image editing program to try to replicate this figure in the lab. And each generation could learn from either one person in the prior generation or five people in the prior generation. So this is kind of the very interconnected society, and this is the not-so-interconnected society. Okay, then after they did the test, they could write up some information up to 2 pages and pass it down the chain. And so the next person down the chain got whatever the person made that hopefully looked like this, and then they got this, and they also got the write-up. So this is our effort to capture cultural transmission. And we can measure this, the skill of the person just by comparing their figure to this. And what you find, so this is 10 generations. They're passing information along here. And when you can only learn from one other person, you can see the skill. They had a really good first round, but then it just kind of bounces around, and they don't get better by the last round. In fact, they get slightly worse. When you can learn from 5 people, you get this rapid increase, so that these guys after the last round are much better than these guys in the last round. So you get this accumulation of skill and know-how. Now, in fact, so this gives you a pretty good look at the data. So this is the first round, and you can see these guys had a lucky first round. They had some good players. These guys, not so good. This is the interconnected 5 group, and this is the 1 group. So these second round doesn't go so well, not so well here. But then somewhere around here, these guys kick in, and then everything starts accumulating. These guys don't go anywhere. So by the last round, the worst person in this group is better than the best person in this group. And that's just the result of the sort of interaction of minds. Okay, so then really a core idea for human evolutionary biology that comes out of all this is that this process is not only relevant now and has been relevant in recent human history, but it actually has driven much of our species' genetic evolution. So in fact, I think it's responsible for our large brains. So genetic evolution gives rise to cultural evolution here, where we have the second system of inheritance. And there you begin generating tools and fire and cooking and useful information. Then there's pressure on genes to build brains that are bigger and better able to acquire, organize, and store that information. But as brains get better at cultural information, there's more of this stuff being generated. So there's more pressure to have bigger brains, and you have an autocatalytic process. Now, this process eventually hits the stops. The primate body plan is such that the birth canal can only get so large without impinging on women's ability to walk and run. And evolution has modified that already, making women less efficient at running because of the trying to get the birth canal as big as possible. But of course, this system has kept zooming along and generates a division of labor, a division of information between males and females where they know different stuff, and eventually a larger division of labor. And then we end up with, you know, storing information extrasomatically, so outside of our brains. All right. So that drives human brain expansion. This is almost the final important point, is that this also leads to a bunch of things which drive our genetic evolution, so specific products. So the black area here are products of cultural evolution that emerged deep in human evolutionary history, which then had important consequences for our anatomy, physiology, and psychology. So let me start with this first one, cooking and fire. So if you look at the size of our teeth and the size of our stomachs and the size of our colons, they're all too small for a primate of our body size who eats the kind of food we eat. But they do make good sense if you think of us as a cooking species. So cooking breaks down food and pre-digests it. So this allowed our body to contract the size and energy required for our colon, our stomach, and our teeth, our chewing apparatus, so we cut things up. Other animals don't have that. So this created a big shrinkage in our digestive tract. It might have also given us an interest in fire that other animals have. We don't know how to innately make fire, and we have to culturally learn how to make fire and cook, so that's the transmitted part. But we're interested in learning about fire, at least during a certain period of childhood. Now, another one, which I'll jump back to this one. So Dan Lieberman has argued that humans are a running species, that we have all these adaptations for long-distance running. We can outrun all kinds of animals. We have springy arches in our feet, which chimpanzees don't have. We have a nuchal ligament in our head, which allows us to turn our body independent. Other primates don't have that. And most importantly, we have a sweating system. So we have all these sweat glands all over our body, and we can really cool ourselves by running. But if you look at that system like an engineer, it's missing something. And what it's missing is a water tank. But if you look at then hunter-gatherers who can chase down prey, they can run for 5 or 6 hours until prey just collapses and just run it into the ground. They're using their knowledge of where water sources are in the environment, how to find water, what plants signal where water is, and also they're carrying canteens, basically, or some kind of water container. So the group most best studied, they carry ostrich eggs. And this allows them to replenish their sweating system, which allows them to run farther than the animals. So it's a package of cultural and genetic evolution. Work with young children shows they have a specialized system for learning about plants and animals. And I'll give you one quick example. If you learn that Felix likes milk, you could assume that that's just something about Felix the cat and not something in general, but kids automatically assume it's about cats. And then if you ask them about a lion, they'll automatically extend it to lions, or tigers, because they have a sort of building a relationship between these species. Similar patterns with artifacts and weapons. The other thing that's interesting that's important for understanding cultural evolution is prestige status. So humans have a type of status called dominant status, which we see in other primates. It's where you control force and force threat, and those, your subordinates are scared, and they bow their heads down to you, and they generally try to avoid you. But in prestige hierarchies, other individuals have useful information. So learners want to pay them deference in order to get access to that information, to be able to hang around and learn from them. So there, people want to be near them and look at them and watch them. So it creates a second kind of status, which has a whole different set of ethological kind of body position patterns. The other thing cultural evolution does is it produces norms, social rules, and it produces how people judge others based on how they do social rules. And this leads to a process of self-domestication. So people learn to be docile rule followers in a way that we don't see in other primates. And then finally, I'll mention ethnic groups. So cultural evolution gives rise to different groups that have different norms or social rules, and they're marked by different languages or dress or dialect. And when we look at young kids, they already have a psychology that carves the world up in certain ways, and they preferentially learn from those who share their dialect, and they preferentially interact with those who share their dialect. And they readily make these, what we think of as stereotypical generalizations based on little bits of information. But that's because they're mapping the world in a way that only would have existed if there was cultural evolution went first. Okay, so let me just summarize a few key points here. So we got to think of our learning abilities as adaptation. So we're evolved to extract useful adaptive information from our world. This creates a second system of inheritance, which runs along in parallel and interacts with genetic inheritance. This leads to culture-driven genetic evolution. So I went through some brief examples of how you get products of culture-driven genetic evolution. And one of the things I only very briefly mentioned there was the process of self-domestication. So because we can learn social rules and we can punish each other through reputational damage and other ways, we became a more docile, cooperative, and pro-social species because we have to learn the local rules, otherwise we get in trouble. So that's a gene culture co-evolutionary process. Crucial to this was expanding our collective brain. So once you can make these social rules, you can build larger groups, you can have bigger collective brains and generate more adaptive technology. And my last point is that we should think of culture as part of our biology, not separate from it. It's part of it in two ways. One, it's driven our genetic evolution, but it's also changes our brains and hormones in ways that we're just beginning to understand. For example, if you've learned to read, you have a thicker corpus callosum than you would have had otherwise, which is the information highway between the two hemispheres of our brain. You also have specialized circuitry for recognizing letters in your left hemisphere. You have a larger verbal memory, and you get more whole brain activation when you hear spoken speech. And that's just one thing, learning to read, that changes your brain. That's all.
Wilcox. I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and it's my honor to be able to moderate tonight's program. So let's get started. I was fascinated by the sheer complexity of the information you bring to bear in your theories and your suggestions about how we became so successful. So let me ask you that one of the things that interested me was that the larger and more interconnected our populations are, you say the more complex our tools will be. Is there a limit?
So we think both theoretically and there is some evidence from laboratory experiments that there is a point at which you get too interconnected where you can stifle the variation you need for the process to work. People become too similar in their ideas. So you should keep enough separateness in order to maintain the variation in the population.
And so is there too large of a population to create?
We haven't found that so far. There's no reason to think that that's a problem.
Interesting. So you certainly have proven the point that two heads are better than one when it looks at learning from generation or from group to group. Is there also more complexity with the larger number of people in the group?
You mean social complexity?
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, this has been the big challenge that humans have faced, is how to scale up society. So you can't get a larger collective brain until you're able to get more and more people to interact in peaceful and productive ways. So a lot of what human societal evolution is figuring out different kinds of institutions which allow more and more humans to, you know, trade but also share information and profitably interact in mutually beneficial transactions. So, yeah.
Great. So you have kind of reconceptualized the notion or the debate about nature versus nurture. I mean, you've added this whole other factor, culture, into that. So how does that affect the equation of nature and nurture?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I take us to be doing here is saying that, you know, that debate is over. We've now solved it. We know we're products of genetic evolution. We know we're closely related to these other species, and it's our very capacities for learning and for nurture to occur is itself a product of natural selection. So by turning the logic of evolutionary theory onto this question, and we've informed it and we filled it out, so I think we can put that one away.
Okay. So in your book, you have a section called Altruism and a Chili Pepper. Can you explain how altruism is like a chili pepper?
Right. Hey, that's another great question. So, as I talked about up here, our ability to learn to like chili peppers requires us to overcome an innate aversion. So, like other primates, we have an innate aversion to eating this kind of pain-inducing substance. But when we grow up and live around other individuals who seem to be enjoying something, we can actually mentally turn pain into pleasure. And so we get that hot sensation, but instead of being, I'm not going to eat that anymore, you're like, that's pretty good, I want some more of that hot sensation. Altruism can be like that, and if we live in a place where giving is good to other people and being altruistic and along some dimension is good, that actually makes us happier. It fires up the reward circuitry in our brains. So what would be a costly, unpleasant thing in a world with different social norms, different beliefs, different reputations, can become a pleasurable, rewarding thing in the right social circumstances, even though you're still giving money away. So there are these experiments on charitable giving where people give to charity and it actually fires their pleasure circuits, the same circuits that fire when they get money. But if you give it to charity, then you get the same kind of feedback.
Wow. So you talk a lot about culture driving our genetic evolution. What, in your mind, could we expect the next human evolutionary modification to be in light of, say, texting? Will it create more flexible thumbs? What do you think is the next human modification?
Right. Well, so the thumbs are only going to occur if that's somehow leading you to have greater reproductive success. Now, I know there's a lot of sexting, but I'm not sure that translates. But two thoughts on that. So, and they're both kind of fun. Right now, cesarean sections are, you know, only in the richer societies, right? But if that were ever to spread and become a general feature of all societies, this is going to relieve a huge selection pressure, which is the selection for our heads to be small enough to fit out of that birth canal. So if you can take them out a different way, then that selection pressure is released, so you'd expect baby heads to get bigger over time. The other one that's interesting and no doubt controversial is that we know there's genetic variation in people's tendency to be religious. And we know that religious people, at least on some of the currently global religions, tend to have a lot more babies. They have higher fertility, even if you control for income and all that kind of stuff. So there should be selection occurring for people to be more religious.
So because we're in the heart of Silicon Valley here, I have to ask you how this cultural coevolution affects creativity.
Well, one of the things that the idea suggests is that a lot of creativity is actually the recombination of different ideas. So if you want to be creative, you should put yourself at the nexus of very different and divergent ways of thinking. I've actually made use of this in my own career because my PhD is in anthropology, but I got many ideas when I moved into the University of British Columbia, where I was sat in a psychology department and in an economics department. And just traveling back and forth from, you know, psychology seminars and economics seminars is stimulating in a way that if you were just in one silo, you would never get stimulated.
So I've also been fascinated by your scholarly history. You are an engineer, a psychologist, anthropologist, archaeologist, linguist, and so forth. Is there a field that you haven't pursued that you think might help you further understand the complexity of our success?
Yes, so I think about that a lot because I always feel like I'm weak in political science and sociology. My ancient Chinese history isn't very good, but I have a good friend who helps me with that. But that's exactly how you do it, is you find good friends and colleagues, and they can provide guidance into these fields and help you not do anything too stupid.
So I couldn't help but think about the book and your theories when I was watching the Iowa caucus last night, and I was wondering what the political process, I mean, how can you explain the political process by virtue of coevolutionary genetic study?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty big question. There's a lot of ways to go with it. I mean, the one obvious, you know, in terms of the political climate, the one obvious insight comes from the emergence of our tribal psychology, which I talk about in the book. So we really are looking for people who, you know, speak with our dialect, share similar ideas, and, you know, there's this kind of way in which you form teams and coalitions with those people, which is pretty obvious in the political climate. And the other way is, it's, you know, just more thinking more broadly is democracy. You know, most societies haven't been democratic. This is a relatively new thing on the human scene. It's trying to tap certain aspects of our psychology, but it's not something that works anywhere. It was able to develop in Europe because there had been a particular history there, and so it's hard to transport it because, you know, there's a glove and hand fit between sort of cultural practices and larger level national institutions.
I also found it interesting with the dialects, the different dialects of the candidates did not necessarily reflect how well they did, because you would think that some of the more unusual dialects we would not be as drawn to by virtue of your studies. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'm going to have to think more about that one. That's certainly true. In fact, a newspaper reporter from the Washington Post was asking me why, you know, Donald Trump is appealing in the South, given that he's a New Yorker. And I have to study the Donald some more.
You'll get back to us?
Yeah, it's going to take years of work.
Okay, so I think about the survival of the fittest as a theoretical model that most of us grew up with. How does that relate to or differ from your basic theories on our evolution?
Yeah, so everything I talked about is just kind of an extension of, it's all an extension of Darwin's original ideas, but of course there's been a lot of advancements made since Darwin's original ideas, but it's an extension of those ideas. And Darwin actually, in The Descent of Man, he begins to talk about cultural evolution. Now, he doesn't make the clean separation that I make between genetic and cultural evolution, but he talks about the acquisition of acquisition of habits, and how this can be a naturally selected process. So he begins to kind of talk about cultural evolution.
So let me take another theory that most of us are familiar with, and that's Maslow's theory of hierarchy of needs. How does that fit into our evolutionary, our cultural evolution?
Well, I mean, human societies all have to, you know, solve basic needs, food and water and whatnot. So different cultural adaptations can help solve those. But what's really impressive about humans is how we get these whole domains of value and reputation that are kind of separate from those. And one of the interesting things about this approach is that you can theorize what biologists would think of as maladaptation, because sometimes the kinds of learning mechanisms I talked about can actually go wrong. And the most obvious place where it goes wrong is something like prestige. So one of the case examples that I like is in Melanesia, so in around Vanuatu and not too far from Fiji. Men became prestigious and got status for growing yams. And then soon, you know, there was a yam competition to see who could grow the biggest yam, and farmers would put all this work and effort into growing the biggest possible yam. But the thing is, at a certain size, the yams become inedible. They're just fibrous. So the whole thing, it was about being a great farmer, but they just became about growing a big yam, and the yams were no longer edible. So it became a big waste of resources to grow supersized yams. So that's the kind of thing where it can go awry due to prestige.
So in your book, you created a new understanding of a subset of the human culture, the weird people. And for those folks who haven't read the book, they might find that interesting. Do you want to just share a little bit about why weird people are overgeneralized?
Yeah, so one of the things that two of my UBC colleagues, Steve Heinen and Aaron Orenzion, have been working on for a number of years is... In 2010, we wrote a paper in which we compiled all the available evidence from around the world where we had a number of different societies that had been measured along some psychological domain. So conformity, ability to solve embedded figures tasks, fairness, willingness to punish others for violations. And we found that Westerners were at the far end of the distribution repeatedly as we put all this data together. So in many ways, to draw psychological conclusions by studying undergraduates at your home university is to draw conclusions from the weirdest people in the world. And WEIRD's an acronym that stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. So it's a critique of psychology and related experimental disciplines.
Thank you. So I know that you have spent time with a number of extremely diverse, indigent individuals around the world, and I was just curious, is there one or two experiences that you had that were truly shocking?
Yeah, I guess one of the things that really struck me is during my first trip, I had been traveling by dugout canoe with a group of Machiganga to more and more remote rivers, and we finally got to like the Machiganga village. These are an indigenous population in the Peruvian Amazon, who was at kind of the end of the farthest river, and so I was spending the night there, and they said to me something like, the first thing they said was, So we heard that Americans have been on the moon. Is that true? And I said, I said, that is true. Americans have been to the moon. And they said, well, are there rocks, are there trees there? No trees. Are there rivers there? No rivers. Are there fish there? No fish. Well, why would anyone want to go there? Well, that's a fair question. I don't have a good answer. And then they said, well, then you come and you have all these machetes and all this stuff, and we hear where they have cars where you're from. How is it that you guys have so much and we have so little? And I was as a grad student at the time. I'll have to get back to you. So I've been working on that problem, so I'll have more to say about that in my next book. But
so we have several questions from the audience. And again, several of them relate to Silicon Valley and our inventions and how smartphones and other developments such as that have affected and will affect human evolution.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that these ideas, where it interfaces with that kind of thing, is just that it's creating more interconnected minds. And so it has the possibility to really stimulate even more innovation. If you can have an idea, I have an idea in Cambridge, and I start talking to a guy in Zurich, and he starts talking to a guy in Beijing, this information can flow really rapidly. You see real bursts in human innovation whenever there's a technological innovation like writing that allows storage and ideas to spread by books, or transport, so ships and things like that.
If socialization provides such a great advantage, why haven't more species adopted it?
Yeah, that's a great question, and chapter 16. I have a whole chapter on that. And to try to make a long story short is that, and the key thing to understand is that when you're a cultural learner, the thing that gives you an advantage is if there's lots of information out there, so there's tools and how to make shelters and tricks to find food that you can acquire if you're a good cultural learner, if you know how to copy and imitate people. But now imagine the world when you're the first one. There's no information out there. There's been no buildup of this accumulated know-how. So you can think of natural selection as an investor. It could invest in this social learning, which is not going to pay off right now because there's nothing in the world to socially learn. Or it can invest in individual learning. You can figure out things on your own in the environment and play around with some tools. And that's going to get you some tools and some tricks just by your own experimentation. So it's always going to keep picking the individual learning. And, you know, chimps are quite good at figuring out by themselves. But it can't switch over to the social learning until there's enough things in the world to learn.
Do we know, or can we determine from your theories, whether or not Neanderthals became extinct because of genetics, culture, or both?
Yeah, I mean, I can't address the question of why. I mean, that's a big debate in the field as to why Neanderthals went extinct. Although the one thing the approach does tell you about Neanderthals, it's often assumed, so first is a fact, Neanderthals have brains that are as big as ours or maybe even bigger. So if it's about brain size and whatever goes along with brain size, then you would expect them to have done well and, in fact, maybe outcompeted us. Instead, we were these African migrants who roared into Europe and kept pushing the Neanderthals back until they eventually went to extinction. So the question is, why is that? Well, the typical assumption has been that it's there must be something different about their brain. So people have suggested it's language or that they have too large a visual cortex or something like that. But another idea is the Neanderthals were adapted to cold Europe, which meant they had to live in very small groups, very widely scattered. Meanwhile, the African variants were living in a much warmer place with richer environments in which they could live in much larger groups. So as we think they invented bows and arrows and lots of other technologies, and this gave them the know-how to then expand out of Africa and possibly exterminate the Neanderthals. So this may have been a kind of replacement, the same way, sadly, in the modern world, Europeans expand with guns, germs, and steel, and now there's no Tasmanians or very few Aboriginals.
I want to remind our listening audience that we are here with Dr. Joseph Henrich, author of The Secret of Our Success. And the next question has to do with how morality is connected to evolution.
So In the book, I talk about the evolution of social norms. So this means we can learn social rules from other members of our social group. We can learn rules for judging others. Then the process I describe in the book is one of the main processes that myself and many others think shape the rules. What kind of rules do we get? So if groups compete, if some groups happen to have rules about how you treat other members of your group, or whether you cooperate in fishing or warfare, all these different things you could cooperate on, those groups tend to succeed and spread and proliferate and even get copied by other groups more than groups with less effective sets of social norms, rules, and institutions. So that gradually over time leads to the evolution of sets of social norms, packages which we can call institutions, that spread. Now, the term morality is a tricky term, but one way to get from social norms to morality is to say when morality gets attached to religious beliefs, when it matters what supernatural agents think. And that probably happened more recently in human history, so the last 10,000 years. When we look at the smallest scale human societies, there's no interweaving between supernatural beliefs and social norms. But as we get to larger scale societies, then supernatural agents begin to care about proper human behavior. They become big moralizing gods that kind of monitor your behavior. And this emerges over historical time. So we probably went from a world of social norms until social norms get wrapped up in these supernatural agents. And myself and a team from UBC have been working on this problem. And we have a paper coming out tomorrow in Nature, which will show that people who believe in big moralizing gods cheat less in an experimental paradigm, suggesting that belief in these supernatural agents may have allowed societies to scale up.
So, what will our culture, what do you think our culture will be known for in 100 years?
100 years. I think probably the secret of our success. No, I'm just kidding. Well, I think we'll be known for some combination of the information age and the biotech age, some merging of those two.
So can you discuss the importance of good teachers in cultural evolution?
Yes.
Formally and informally, good teachers.
Sure. So there's actually been a lot of recent work on this, and now across human societies, there's now good evidence, and it wasn't clear for a while, that a variety of forms of teaching go on. So humans seem to have these pedagogical cues which help young learners cue in on what they need to know. Now, Western societies are unusual in this, so they do, I mean, depending on which cue you pick, an order of magnitude more teaching, more prompting than people in small-scale societies, but we can detect it in the small-scale societies as well. And it really seems to help the learner home in on what they need to learn, because there's many things you could imitate, but if you have a cooperative teacher, then they help point you in the right direction.
So what is the fastest example of cultural gene coevolution in humans that you know of?
Yeah, so we know what the fastest one is. So sometime after 10,000 years ago, humans domesticate animals they can milk, so goats and cows. And so that begins to spread. Now, in some populations, they rapidly develop cheese and yogurt processing technology, because the sort of ancestral state for humans that we share with other primates is that, and this is actually the mammalian case, that we can process milk, we can break down lactose, we produce an enzyme called lactase, but then around age 5, humans, that shuts down. But then because there was the spread of this spread of cows and animals that we can milk, there was an opportunity for adults to get the benefits available in milk if they could only continue to be able to break down the lactase sugars. So this didn't happen in places without any dairying, without any cows or other animals, and this didn't happen in places where they quickly developed other technologies. So if you make certain kinds of yogurt or certain kinds of cheese, then adults can eat those, and they can still get the benefits of the nutritional bounty in milk. But if you were just a herding group, then you needed to be able to have genes that could process the milk. And so in Europe this happened, and in Africa. There's actually 5 different mutations in humans that can shut down the normal shutoff system that shuts down the lactose processing in humans and allow adults to continue to process lactose. So it doesn't happen very much in the Middle East or in China because they quickly developed the cheese and yogurt processing technology. And each of those genes we can date. So for example, we think we know the camel gene. So that was the lace one. That was only a few thousand years ago that there was a gene that emerges in nomadic populations, the camel herders.
Another interesting question from our audience. Does the connectivity and complexity of the internet reduce the need for biological evolution for an ever-increasing and complex brain?
Yeah, so the, genetic evolution never stops. You can't turn it off. It'll just go in new directions. And so I mentioned the cesarean section possibility, there's the religion example that I used. But when you can do studies, and there's still lots of selection process, selection acting on it, it's still active for sure.
Another question that I'm not sure I understand, so I hope you do. Did male homosexuality's inventiveness outweigh limitations on productivity?
Right. This isn't in the book, but I teach widely enough that I have an answer to this that I give in my classes. So, maybe the way you can understand this question is, what's the origin of male homosexuality? This is homosexuality. This is a good evolutionary question because normally sex in other animals is for reproduction, although it turns out there's a lot of same-sex pairing in other animals. And I think the best idea out there is once you have a system that is for biological reproduction, it's humans have pair bonding, so there's a whole emotional apparatus that can go along with sex, and humans can use that to create pair bonds with same-sex members. And different societies haven't deployed that in different ways. So in lots of societies in New Guinea, homosexuality is widespread. Large fractions of males have males that they have sex with before they get married, and then they go on to get married and have kids. In fact, there are rituals in which every male has homosexual sex with an older member of his group, and this is just routine practice of the society.
So here's a parenting question. You discuss how we are naturally biased towards same-sex learning, or learning from those of same sex in our immediate culture. Girls learn from moms, boys learn from dads, etc. Can you suggest ways that same-sex parents or single parents raising children can adjust to provide a better, more well-rounded upbringing?
I don't think that's a problem because kids are naturally broad in who they pay attention to. So in the villages I work in, for example, kids all play in mixed-age play groups. And, the boys will tend to clump together and whatnot, but they're fairly well mixed. So all you got to do is provide enough of an environment so the kids have access to a wide variety of models and they can choose for themselves.
So unfortunately, we've come to the time in our program where we have time for only one more question. And that would be, do you share the fear of machines that have become so self-learning and self-aware that some people feel?
I don't have that, but it could be due to a lack of knowledge in that department.
Well, thank you very, very much.
I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Joseph Henrich, author of The Secret of Our Success. We are also grateful to Colleen Wilcox of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and to all of you for joining us this evening. This meeting is now adjourned.